say my name until the city burns and the stars fade away and your scars don't hurt. I will hold you till the sun comes crashing down. I'm yours until the end of time.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Restored to More podcast, a listener-supported podcast that is dedicated to restoring marriages to wholeness in Christ after being affected by pornography and sexual brokenness.
After betraying Charity with pornography and unwanted sexual behavior, we had no idea how to rebuild our relationship or even if it was possible to restore what was broken.
Today, by God's grace, we have learned how to connect again, laugh again, and rebuild spiritual, emotional, and sexual intimacy to an even greater experience than before.
Our goal is that as you hear our story, the stories of others, and the knowledge needed to heal, you too can have a marriage that is becoming restored to more.
I'm yours until the end of time.
Update everyone. Course 1 registrations are back open. Whoop whoop. This is an 8-week course starting Thursday, September 14th that is designed to help you and your spouse start the journey to becoming restored to more. It will be led by R2M certified coaches, Cody and Michelle Larson. We will be focusing on how to cultivate safety and trust, healthy communication, deal with triggers, and begin to discover how God can use crisis to create closeness. You can see all the details on our website and can register today at www.restoredtomore.com/courses. Also, if you have appreciated this podcast, a great way to say thank you is leaving a 5-star rating and a positive review. These reviews help more people find the podcast and experience hope and healing.
Say my name until the city.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Restored to More. This morning we got the awesome privilege to be interviewing Debbie Laser again for part 2. Dr. Mark Laser and Debbie Laser founded Faithful and True Ministries, providing counseling services for individuals and couples. They have intensive workshops for men, their spouses, and couples who are widely considered life-changing by those who attend. Mark and Debbie Laser have written over 15 books on the subject of sexual addiction, including Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction and Shattered Vows. Her recent research project, Post-Traumatic Growth in Relationally Betrayed Women, was published in the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy. Faithful and True is widely considered one of the leading Christian sexual addiction treatment centers in the country. Welcome, Debbie Laser.
Well, I just love being here with you both. You're so energized by all these topics, and I tell you, you get me going. You know, I can feel my heart rate going, just looking forward to talking about what we're going to talk about today. So I'll let you lead the way, but I'm ready to answer any questions you have.
The first thing we're diving into today is post-traumatic growth. Now, there are many different mindsets when it comes to trauma that happens. There are many different kinds of ways to categorize betrayal and what that looks like. And from what we've understood about the ministries that you lead and what you do, you guys have adopted a post-traumatic growth mindset and model. Can you talk a little bit about what is post-traumatic growth?
I sure can. And it's where I have a tremendous amount of passion and purpose. So I would say that this came to life for me when I was in my graduate program, actually, and working on my thesis. And while I knew in my own life, because this had been years after my own crash and burn with Mark and his sexual addiction, I knew that in my own life that our journey through recovery and the counseling we experienced and many, many things we learned along the way had led to a very different person, I felt, of who I had become. Mm-hmm. I knew that I had grown through it all, and I also knew that it was an incredibly traumatic experience when I first found out about the secrets of Mark's life. But in graduate school, I came across this term, post-traumatic growth, and I began researching that, and that became the topic of my thesis for my graduate program. Wow. And I felt like I was on fire with everything that was coming together for me spiritually, experientially, and now research-oriented. Because post-traumatic growth is the name that two psychologists from the University of North Carolina by the name of Tedeschi and Calhoun had coined in their research about many, many traumatic life experiences. Mm. They were looking in their lifetime around things like natural disasters and terminal illness and death of loved ones and war and many, many trials and adversities like that in people's lives. And they had created some assessments to determine in their research whether people who had gone through these kinds of traumatic events actually had any positive outcomes that came from that.
Wow.
One of the things in the history of psychology, really, and medicine was studying what trauma does to people. And it's true, trauma creates all kinds of symptoms emotionally and physically. And I think there was a lot of focus on the fact that trauma really damaged a person. And Tedeschi and Calhoun came along in the late 90s to want to look at the truth that maybe things are hurt when we face traumatic events in our life, and there may be the possibility that there's also growth that comes out of that. And that's what they found in their research, which was incredible. So what I love about it is it really exemplifies the both and that we also teach so much at Faithful and True, that if we can get out of our black and white thinking that something either has to be this way or that way. In other words, You either have to be traumatized and therefore you struggle with all kinds of issues and symptoms and distress the rest of your life, or trauma isn't that big of a deal. And if you just looked at it the right way and willed yourself out of it, perhaps, you know, you could just find the good in it. What Tedeschi and Calhoun were saying is it's a both and. Mm. Trauma creates an incredible amount of distress in our life, and if we have the right resources, it can also lead to an incredible amount of growth.
Wow.
So out of that, you know, my belief is that, and theirs too, is that trauma and transformation can coexist. And that's really what post-traumatic growth is talking about.
I love that. So, I mean, that's a big deal, because the difference in that from other models are out there is saying that once you go through trauma, you won't recover. You won't have this idea of restoration in your own life. There's not an area for growth. This is just, you're just stamped. Like, you're boom. You are now a trauma survivor or a victim. And it's almost a victim mindset where because I have gone through this, I will forever have this issue. I'll never be able to transform or grow out of it.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right, Clinton, in that. That's one of the saddest things about it, is that people who have endured a lot of trauma in their life, and many people now are studying their histories and looking at family of origin issues and how they might have been abused or neglected in their life along the way. If we're not careful, they can end up in a place of believing, I am so damaged by so many things that have happened to me or I've been neglected by, that I'll never be able to thrive in life.
Wow.
And post-traumatic growth says that isn't true. In fact, one of the most outstanding pieces of data that came out of my research, which was looking at post-traumatic growth in relationally betrayed women. So I took the findings of Tedeschi and Calhoun, who had been studying the research of other traumatic events, and my research was the first to take all of their information and put it specifically into the stories of women who had been relationally betrayed.
Wow.
And one of the things we found, which we really weren't looking for at the time, was that those who had been the most traumatized by betrayal actually were the ones that came out with the highest readings of growth.
Mm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's actually the opposite of what many would believe. And I think it gives us great, great hope that we do not need to live in a surviving place, no matter how life has dealt us trauma and adversity, that we all have the potential of thriving if we have the right resources and support to move through these very traumatic situations. You know, I can remember Clinton sitting in a couple session with Mark one time, and there was a man in his wife, and she had had, I think, what she would have described as a fairly loving and kind and safe environment growing up, and yet he was the one with a story with a lot of abuse and neglect in his life. And I think for both of them, you know, she felt like this poor guy, it was kind of a pitying place of, you know, I don't know, I mean, he's just gonna have to suffer, I think, a lot more, and he's just missing a lot, that's for sure. And, you know, it was kind of a self-righteous place on her side. And I remember him just sitting there, you know, kind of bent over in a lot of shame about there and feeling rather hopeless about his future because of all he had dealt with as a child. I had just finished some of my research coming out of graduate school, and I remember bringing in what I had found, and I shared with him this research that actually they had found that those who had struggled the most, just like you said, had actually had the opportunity to thrive the most and find the most healing. Mm. When I shared that with him, it was like his head looked up with some new possibility of life for himself that just was amazing to see, the hope, you know, that he was carrying when he left that room. That, I believe, is what I want to provide for anyone that comes to me. And, you know, it's true. I work specifically with betrayed women and couples. And I know that if we're not careful, we can leave them in this place of victimization and surviving and not in a place of knowing that there is thriving available to them.
Amen.
And, you know, biblically, we read this all over the place. James 1:2 is one of my favorite verses about, you know, and I never used to like that, consider it pure joy when you face many trials. You know, I'm like, well, that's not exactly what I would say when I'm facing trials. And yet today, after going through any number of things, I would say the greatest, earliest trial in my life was the sex addiction crash and burn. And, you know, now that I'm so much older and I've lived a lot more life, there have been many, many other trials that have come along as well. And what I know is that I've learned to look for different things instead of the why me, God? And, you know, how in the world am I ever going to live life after this kind of, you know, filter that can sometimes get in the way of thriving. I've now learned to ask a different question is, what would you have me learn in this? How do you want me to grow through this? And what I've learned is there's just all kinds of things that he wants me to grow up in spiritually and to become a more Christ-like person and to have a better handle on how to love people and be compassionate for others and serve him. So
I love that. You know, what I hear you saying is, and this is really important in my opinion for the guys as well as the girls, because the women that go through betrayal, obviously all of this really pertains to them. But for me, even just viewing pornography at a young age, that was the traumatic experience that I had had. You know, I didn't necessarily come from a background of sexual abuse or molestation or things that my parents did. But for me, viewing those images was a very traumatic experience, knowing that I wasn't even really looking for it. And it found me more than I found it. And, right. And then to go through a life of lying and the shame and even being involved in church activities and yet living such a double life, up until even my mid-20s and then getting married and still living a dual life. You know, when you say that, it makes me smile and get emotional because the guys need to hear that as well as the people that are betrayed. They're going through the same thing. They have these traumas in their life that they have never known how to overcome. And changing the question from why to what, that was the pivotal moment in which my reaction or point of view changed towards my addiction. It was no longer, why, God, haven't you taken this away? And why, God, aren't you healing me? And why, God, are you allowing me to go through this? Instead, it became, what, God, do you want me to learn from this? And what, God, do you want me to respond with? And when I asked that question, everything changed. Because God, I no longer was angry at God. It became a point of, God, what can I do to understand what you're doing here? And that was when God's word really became alive in a different way to me, because he then showed me how he wanted to give me the grace every day and in every moment to handle the temptation and the previous trauma and the previous shame and the previous lies and all these things. God was going to walk with me in that season of growth so that I could actually mature and come out of that. That what you said just really got me thinking. That was a very powerful
And I'm so glad you bring that up, Clinton, because post-traumatic growth is not just for betrayed wives. Clearly, I mean, the original studies were about all kinds of trauma and trials in our life. And you are absolutely true when you say post-traumatic growth is there for men who struggle with addiction as well. And that's what I love about our center is we're focused on finding thriving for both sides. It's not just for one or the other. You too have an incredible amount of pain that has followed you in life from the experiences you've undergone in your own life. And they're different kinds of pain than perhaps a betrayed woman, and yet they are painful, and that's what's led to your coping. And so we can all learn so much from this, and we become, which is one of the things maybe we'll talk about here in a bit, how do we become allies in our relationship, you know, as we move forward? Mm. And I think one of it is accepting that we've both endured a lot of pain in a lot of different ways, and we both have the potential of growing through that. And that God can heal some of that and grow us up in new ways with our character and with our ability to love others and serve him. That's offered to all of us, you know, regardless of what that trial has looked like originally.
So true. Clint and I have been recently talking about just how many similarities we actually had in our healing journey and how we both had to overcome a lot of things and a lot of different feelings. We're very similar, different situation, but very similar feelings. And so it helps us relate to each other and connect on a level, since we both have realized that we've gone through similar feelings like denial, like shame, you know, like trauma. When a couple, I feel like, can realize that, then they'll be able to start growing and just rebuilding intimacy together for sure.
Yes, I totally agree with that, Charity.
And one thing before we transition to the next thing, I just wanted to hit on the point of, you know, everything that you're talking about is just so hope driven. And I think more women, in my opinion, would be more inclined to open up and get healing for themselves if they knew that it was around a post-traumatic growth model. Because I think a lot of women see the process of healing and it's daunting. I remember in the beginning of my own story and my own process of healing was I just remembered seeing women who had been in my same shoes and were still having triggers, you know, 30 years down the road. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I don't want that to be a part of my story. And there's nothing wrong with that person, but I just knew that there was more in my life. I knew that I wanted to have a marriage that was going to be thriving. And I think if more women knew of this model and had heard of this type of mindset, I think more women would be more inclined to sign up for healing.
That's a really interesting thought, you know, Charity, because I think much of recovery in our field of sex addiction is very focused on the behaviors and who's done the behaviors and how we need to stop the behaviors. And that maybe our hope comes from the fact that we can eliminate enough of that we don't have to think about it or be triggered by it. Mm. And I'm not saying that it isn't important to stop certain behaviors, because that is going to be important. Yeah, totally. However, the thriving and the post-traumatic growth, I believe, is much more than that. Yeah. The behavioral solutions are only the first part of this. And post-traumatic growth is, again, more about our lives as individuals, really.
Yes.
And not even about marriage, for that matter. It's really about what we're learning individually and how God is growing us up spiritually. Mm. And when we can take the focus off the behaviors and put it on these other things, I think that's where, in time, ideally, it becomes less and less of a focus and even a conversation in our life. Mm. I often kid, you know, people often ask me, you know, well, you know, when did you stop thinking about Mark as being an addict or whatever? And I said, you know, the truth is we had such great help early on that, you know, it was, you know, surely for 5 years or so, and I don't mean this to mean all day, every day, but there was focus on growth and counseling and various things like that. But, you know, it really had it had morphed into so many other things in terms of relational things and learning how to ask for our needs and talk about our feelings and thoughts in deeper ways with one another and creating safety in our relationship. It became about so many other things that if we weren't talking about it every day because we were in our counseling center together, it really would not have been on my radar much at all, to be honest. And so, you know, the fact that we worked together in the field for so long, of course, you know, put it forefront in terms of our conversation. But honestly, it was very much on the back burner when it came to life itself.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I love that. I love sharing that. You know, just to change gears a little bit, we would love to dive into a little bit of the intimacy, since you hit on that a little bit. You guys were doing stuff together, sure, and you're learning together. You know, we have so many couples that have told us that they want to heal and they want to find a way to reengage one another. I mean, everybody gets married because we want a great marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, we get married because we have this idea that, man, this person, I love them so deeply and so dearly that we're going to have a great life together. And as you know, Discovery Day or, you know, whatever it's called, it throws that entire plan that I think it makes the guy aware that this is not how he intended it to be, and denial can get broken, and the woman's dreams are absolutely shattered. I would love to hear a little bit about how you guys were able to go through that healing process and begin that intimacy rebuilding in your relationship.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to back up just a little bit, Clinton, to say, first of all, that I think maybe we have a distorted viewpoint about intimacy in our life with, yes, our spouse.
Absolutely.
Believing that everything was wonderful and we were very connected. And I think what is true, what we believe and teach about relationship building and the development of our relationship, is early on in a relationship, we do create a time that we call enmeshment or infatuation. Mm. And most couples can remember that. We're just, you know, we're just high in the sky in love with each other. We can spend endless hours talking about things. We can sacrifice so many of our needs along the way to attend to the other person. It's really kind of a surreal time with one another that in the moment feels like it's real and it will last forever. And we've never found anyone who serves our needs the way this person is serving them, and that we've really found the person who will make us happy and make us whole. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is a natural part of this stage of infatuation. What is true, though, is that never lasts for anyone forever. And
yep,
generally, true, 6 months to 2 years is the time we see when we get back to the realism of living our lives and we both have things we need to attend to, whether it's our work or school or parenting or whatever it is. And we also start to realize that we're not always there able to tend to all of the needs of the other person. And so one way or another, some disappointments start showing up in our relationship.
Sure.
The real struggle becomes, can we talk about it? Mm. And can, when these things seem hard or when we're in conflict about something, what do we do about that?
Mm. Man,
and in most,
good,
of our relationships, we already start the system of what we call coping in unhealthy ways because we don't know how to talk about things, or we're afraid to, or we reach instead to get busy or work too much or watch a pornography, whatever, on our computer, or have a glass of wine or whatever it is. We turn to some things that help us manage these emotions that now are starting to show up that might say at some point, gosh, I'm a little lonely right now, or I'm a little disappointed in my spouse, or gosh, I wish they had said that to me because that would have felt really nice, and they didn't, and I don't know why they didn't. And, you know, all of a sudden, we're off to the races.
Yep.
And then those of us who have faced into betrayal can easily blame everything on betrayal.
Mm.
And secrecy and lies. The truth is, though, there are patterns in our relationships, all of them, that have involved ways we have not been able to deal with things along the way.
Yeah.
And so building intimacy, in my mind, is really, it's really the journey of being known by someone, fully known. Mm. And by that, I mean sharing what we're feeling, what we're thinking, what we're needing, what our desires of our heart are, what's really true for us, rather than just talking about behaviors, which is really a more common way to converse with other people. We talk about our day at work, or we talk about what the kids have done today, or we ponder about our next vacation, or is the car needing some help because it, you know, it broke down yesterday. We talk about a lot of behaviors. But when it comes to really sharing what's inside of me, what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, what I'm believing about things, whether it's true or not, what my desires in my heart. Those are things that I think we find take a lot of practice to share that way with someone else.
Wow.
So, you know, just to share part of my own story, I mean, it's true that Mark's supposedly secret life is what led to our crash and burn. It's also true that I was a master of withdrawal in our marriage. And when I was worried about something, or I didn't think Mark cared about me the way I thought maybe he should or whatever, I didn't talk about it. You know, I just withdrew. And I didn't share what I was thinking or feeling. I didn't ever ask to get help about any of these things. So in some ways, I was also not fully showing up in our relationship. You could call that lying and hiding too, if you really want to. And I don't want to compare this to, and I don't want this to be an apples to apples kind of thing when we're talking about lying about infidelity, because that's a really big thing. I am, though, saying that intimacy requires both of us to do this differently if we're really going to grow as a couple. And for us, it took learning for the first time, really, how to be totally truthful with one another and trust that we could be safe when we did so, and that we were there for one another. So I guess that's my easiest definition.
No, that is insanely good. Okay, I got to hit on a couple of things there.
Yes.
So here is what I think happens a lot of time with couples, is that they go through the betrayal, or at least they find out about the betrayal. It was already going on.
Yeah.
And it was going on because of a few different reasons. One, most men have never learned how to be intimate, right? We just are not taught. That's our right. Culture does not teach us how to be known. And I think there's this lies that if we really ever tell somebody that we're scared of something, that's unmanly. And if we ever tell somebody that we're not okay, well, we should always have our stuff together, because that's what guys do. Guys are, strong, and we're burly men, and we can handle anything, man. Nothing makes us feel scared or weak or fearful. And so those things obviously engage our addiction, because if we can't communicate things that are unwanted emotion, we're going to medicate them, right? Two options. We're going to healthily deal with emotions, which normally leads to intimacy with other men and women in a healthy way, mostly our spouses if we're married, or we're going to medicate them. So that leads to addiction. Well, on the woman's side, as a wife, what we have experienced too is that If we're out of that so-called honeymoon stage, which is what you were saying, that 6 months to 2 years, right? If you're out of that honeymoon stage and you're dissatisfied with your marriage, I think a lot of people internalize that and think something's wrong with me.
Yes.
And then they're gonna isolate. So now we have two people that are isolating, probably doing different things. Like you said, I agree with you. It's worse to betray your spouse medicating your emotions than just hiding it. But both people are hiding their emotions in different ways, which leads to a discovery day of usage of the guy medicating. And it's easy for the wife to say, oh my gosh, not only does he have to learn how to live a sober life, but now we have to learn how to communicate our emotions. That is so hard. Like now in the midst of there's betrayal, it's almost like you have this recipe that was kind of already bad. It was already a bad recipe. The marriage wasn't going well before there was the discovery of pornography use or worse things, because there was already an isolation factor going on. And now you add that to the mix, and it can be this hard thing. But here's the truth. If a couple doesn't learn how to communicate now, they're going to take those same practices into the next relationship. And the woman can think easily that the guy is going to, she should leave him and go find somebody else who's going to be better. But if the guy she marries next, if that guy hasn't ever learned to be intimate, you're going to have the same issues in a different recipe, and it's still going to be bad.
Yes, I totally agree. And that's why our belief, again, is that thriving is not just about behavioral changes. You know, it's about all these other things you're talking about. And the only thing I would say is different maybe for a lot of couples is it's a both and. There are a lot of good things about our relationship, and there are some things we're hiding away and medicating.
Yes.
You know, I mean, for Mark and me, I mean, there were many, many great things in my opinion. I really thought we had a great marriage, and we did in many, many ways. And there were these parts of it where it felt like we just missed each other. Or there was, I always say, it felt like there was something missing, and I could not figure out what was missing. What I've come to realize what was missing were those ways where we were both finding coping. We call it coping, if faithful and true. That's a negative term, meaning we're unhealthily finding ways to medicate or exit our emotions. We were both finding ways to do that. We were using different ways. And granted, I mean, sexually acting out, too, was only one way Mark was using. I mean, we all have multiple ways that we're coping. So to say that a person only uses one form of coping is not true either.
Sure.
However, it may be the most painful one and the one that hurts the other person the most. But we have multiple ways. I mean, I easily coped with overparenting. I had in many opportunities just pour myself into my kids' lives when I was not knowing what to do about situations with Mark, or work was another way I coped, and withdrawing was another way. But we all have multiple ways we do that. And I think when we're both in those coping stances, we are pulling ourselves away from the relationship. And that's when I know I started having these feelings of there's something missing. You know, we're like missing each other because we're out here in kind of on our own little islands living life, and it's working pretty much. And to the world, it's looking like we're still a great couple. And there's so much more for us, which is about the post-traumatic growth from trials, I believe.
Yeah, I think we all have this deep longing for connection and to really be known, like you talk about in your guys' other book. And, but we just, for some reason, you know, whether it's childhood, growing up, trauma, whatever, we don't even know how to do that. And so we run to other things to cope for our lack of intimacy and connection, like, you know, a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream for, you know, just to hide in all of our emotions because we don't know how to communicate such large emotions to other people.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. We are like writing a book over here on our notes.
Are you?
We take so many notes every time we talk to you.
It's so amazing. And it's incredible. It's gold. I would love, Debbie, for you to talk about, because I know I had heard in one of your talks before, there was 12 steps of what you believe healthy couples have committed to doing. And last time we talked, you said that there's 15 steps. So
we've expanded that a little bit.
That is so awesome. And these really helped me. And I love these. And I would love if you wouldn't mind just sharing on these steps of what you believe healthy couples have committed to doing.
I'd be glad to do that. This is one of those anecdotal research projects that Mark and I often undertook when we were in the car driving someplace. And we often were just brainstorming as we thought about all the couples we were working with. You know, why is it some seem to be thriving more than others? And so we started creating these lists of things that we were kind of putting out there in terms of couples we work with. And it ended up being pretty truthful, I think, even without being actual research, peer-related research about things that our couples were doing who were really thriving. Mm-hmm. So the first of those was really built on the foundation that there was sobriety and there was truth-telling in the relationship. Mm-hmm. Now, those are two really big things. Because the first one, of course, sobriety is not something that just happens all that easily, you know, for people who are struggling with addiction. And there's a lot of work that goes into being a sober person. So I don't want to take that lightly. I also know that when there's a lot of slipping and sliding around or relapse, what we have come to know is that it becomes futile to try to work on growing a relationship or a marriage, because all the issues end up coming back to that again. Yeah. And it doesn't give us the opportunity to work on other things in the relationship. And there are plenty of other things to work on in terms of growing a marriage. So Mark and I actually made a commitment with our couples that if we were in marriage counseling and someone was working on sobriety and they hit a season of time where they were really struggling with that, that we paused the marital work and we went back to figuring out what was missing in that person's individual program such that they could not maintain sobriety, because we felt it was so foundational to, again, working on the relationship.
So good.
So that's the first one. And as part of number one is truth-telling, which maybe is another old podcast one day for us, but it's about our belief of doing full disclosure with one another about all the sexual history including what has happened to someone and also how it has led to addictive and habitual patterns of acting out sexually, including everything from birth to the present. Mm. So this truth-telling process is one, too, that in our minds set up a new foundation for a couple to live in total truth about the past. Mm. And we have just found that that leads to many other things that are important along the way for both of them to be able to talk about intimacy. We want to be able to talk about anything with each other. If there are still things that haven't been talked about in terms of the addiction, that's going to get in the way of creating intimacy. Mm. So number one, big pieces here, sobriety and truth-telling are so important. Number two, do you want me just to go on or do you want to ask me about each one?
You can just comment. Keep going. So we know, okay, so one thing we know is that we are not going to be able to dive into each of these 15 things in detail. And and so we are so excited for our listeners to go and find out more about these things, to go into your books. And I think that every single one of these could be a separate podcast. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can just keep going, Debbie, and hit on what you think are the main points of each one. And we'll just add comments here and there.
Yeah, that sounds good. And you are right. Trying to talk about these at length, I'm sure we won't have time today. Mm-hmm. But a second thing that we know is really important for couples that do well is they commit to three equal pieces of their journey, meaning he has his most likely counselor, he has his support group or groups, he has possibly a counseling group, a therapeutic group, and his community of other men who are also walking in this journey with him. So that would be a piece for him. In the same way, we know that couples that do well, she has the exact same kinds of things in her life. She has an individual counselor to go to talk about anything she needs to. She also is developing a community of other women who are walking through this journey. In a perfect world, there'd be a therapy or counseling group that she's a part of, or at the very least a support group that she can be a part of. And then a third piece is some place to go to talk about marital issues. Mm. Now, I don't want this to negate what I just said about number one, because for some couples, this marital work in the beginning might actually be about establishing a time of separation for the couple. If there's so much toxicity or there is so much pain in the relationship that really they can hardly live side by side or speak to one another without creating a lot of pain with each other, we have found that helping a couple and guiding them through separation can be very redemptive and therapeutic for them. So again, it's not necessarily about growing the marriage at that time as it is about helping them find safety within the marriage. But those three equal pieces we've found have been essential to a couple to grow. And oftentimes there is a piece missing. Yes, Terry.
Can I ask you a question really quick on this?
Sure. Of course.
You know, what Clint and I have found and just the little bits and pieces that we've been working with individuals and couples is we're finding that that there's just this gap, I guess, of women wanting to admit that they need help as well and just believing that it's the guy who needs help. And I'm just curious if you could speak on that at all or why do you think that is, and maybe helping the women understand how crucial it is for them to get help too?
Well, in the beginning, I would call help not so much you need to figure out what's wrong with you, which is unfortunately what many women believe might be what's going to happen if they commit to this journey. What I really believe is we need support with all this pain we're experiencing. And, you know, because when we're in pain, it gets really hard to work through a lot of the physical symptoms we're dealing with, as well as our emotional symptoms and also the belief systems. And what I know is true from a lot of my research is that it's our beliefs about ourselves and our spouse and the world that create this pain that we're in. You know, you had mentioned it, Clinton and Charity, I think both of you, that one of the beliefs, for instance, that the majority of us wives believe when we have found out infidelity in our marriage is that we are probably the reason why that happened. We have not been enough. We don't look good enough. We are not sexual enough. We're not tall enough. We're not this enough. We're not smart enough. Whatever it is, most of us believe that there is something missing for ourselves, which is why our husbands have landed on this addiction for themselves. Those beliefs create a ton of pain in us. I remember just weeping beside my bed, you know, really going over all these things that I must not have been when I first heard Mark's story about this. I needed support with that. You know, I needed someone to tell me this isn't about me. I didn't cause this addiction in Mark. I really can't control it. I can't cure it. There's many more things. You know, I remember people saying, I want you to learn about this. And I remember in the beginning thinking, well, I don't know if that's going to change my mind, but okay, I'll listen. I needed that kind of support for someone to hold my hand and tell me I was going to be okay and that this is really some truths about this and maybe not what you're thinking. That's the kind of support I want women to have in the beginning. Now, eventually, if that leads to her learning some things about herself, that's going to be great because, as I know, there's always things for us to learn in all of our life. You know, there are always things being presented in our life and in our experiences that will lead to us changing and growing who we are to become a better person if we want that part of the journey too.
So good.
That's amazing. And I think, you know, you hit on something that is just, I like what Charity said. There's a gap. And I think that it is very hard for people like Charity and I who want to come alongside women and we want to support them, like you're saying, but it does take a woman to admit that she is being greatly affected by this. And I think sometimes the betrayed imitates the addict in the sense of denial that I'm fine. Okay. This is his issue. He's going to handle it. And okay, whatever. And I think that's one of the things we pray for all the time is that women would just be able to say, this is affecting me. And they would run to places like your programs and Charity and I, who are going to look at the wife and say, listen, yes, we're all for marriage, but we're not saying right now you need to just forgive him and stick it out. What we're saying is we want to come alongside you because you are an independent person of him. And we want your health and we want you to understand that there has probably been some sense of pain and we want to help you not get healed because you're messed up or you're broken, but we would love to support you in the journey of going through the pain and understanding how to feel whole. Because right now you probably feel like you're the reason for this and you probably feel like you played a part in this. And really his addiction has very little to do with you at all. And your actions and your behaviors are not why he's doing this. He has issues that are separate from you. Now we just want to help support you in the pain that you're going through.
You know, I find that there are a lot of reasons why women may not get involved in the journey. I think certainly one of them is the fear that professionals will tell her there is something wrong with her and that she caused it. And, you know, that's a very real fear because unfortunately in my research, I found that that was still advice that was being given to many women. Yep. But I think there are other things too. Money is certainly one of them that I find gets in the way. Many couples don't feel like they have the resources to enter into this journey and the expense of it because it can be expensive. Mm-hmm. And I know that was true for us. I was talking about that earlier when Mark was fired from his work. We didn't have money. I was thinking to myself, well, if our money needs to go anywhere, it surely needs to go to Mark to help him. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of women think that way as well.
Yeah.
Let's go to the person who's bleeding the worst right now and I'll just manage. Because I think one of the common characteristics of most of us women are that we're very responsible and independent, most of us. And we do believe we can manage it on our own. And so we'll do our darndest to try to do that while we give the rest of whatever we can to our spouses to find healing for them. So I think it can come from there. I know for myself, and I think this is true for a lot of women, that even though I'd been hurt by Mark's behaviors, I still loved him. And I didn't want to destroy him as a person or his reputation. And I didn't want to think about going out there talking in a lot of negative ways about him or whatever, because I know this maybe sounds crazy when someone's hurt you. But I think it comes from that place of really loving him.
Yeah.
And so I really didn't know what that was going to look like if I got into a journey where people going to want me to, you know, really go after him and, you know, have all kinds of hatred and blame and this and that. And, you know, there was a part of me that there were so many people already angry with him. I didn't want to be another one that was beating him down. So, you know, there are lots of reasons that make it difficult to get involved. But mostly I say to women, what I know for myself is when I'm in a lot of pain about anything, that's when I'm tempted to not be my best, you know. And if what I want is to also work on being the best version of myself and to work on being more Christ-like, there's no time like being in pain where I can really kind of put myself under a microscope to figure out what it is I want to work on doing differently. So that's a great starting point for most women. We usually don't like either how angry and rageful we've gotten or how shut down and quiet we've gotten. Either one are kind of on either side of the continuum.
Yeah.
And that's a great place to start, you know, to work on some things we would like to change about who we are.
Yeah. You talk about number three being closing door, you know, not threatening divorce if working a program.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I came up with this one actually in our list because what I know is I wasn't the best at this early on, you know, and I never used the word divorce with Mark because I don't know that in my mind I didn't really think about it that much, to be honest. I didn't have a history, a family history of people divorcing. You know, my parents had persevered many, many years in marriage together. So it wasn't the first thing that came to my mind, but I did use very vague language like, I'm not sure I can stand this anymore, you know, when I would be really upset about something. And Mark was interpreting that as meaning I was probably starting to think about leaving the relationship out of fear. And what happens when either of us begin to believe that the other person is ready to walk out is we will start placating more. Placating meaning we will do whatever we need to do in terms of not telling the whole truth sometimes, hiding some things we're doing or whatever, because the last thing we want is for that person to walk out the door. So again, if we're working on intimacy building, we need to shut the door on divorce at least for a time is what we say. We know that it may not be a lifetime because it depends on whether there's going to be sobriety and there's going to be intentionality to both people in this journey. But if we don't shut the divorce door, then we leave the other person afraid and tempted to lie and hide. And that's paradoxical to what we're trying to work on in terms of building intimacy.
Now, what you're saying is it's almost for a period of time, though. You're not saying that, and I think that's important for people to hear.
Forever.
We're not saying that, okay, we're going to burn the bridges or we're going to burn the ships and we're going to work through this. Right. You're saying, hey, right now, in the midst of working this program, we're going to choose to not talk about divorce. We're going to choose to let that not be an option right now, just for right now.
Right. And we encourage, ideally a year, you know, if they're both fully engaged in a program, at the very least 6 months. Because, you know, I have some women like saying to their spouses, well, you know, in 2 months, I'm going to reevaluate what you're doing and how this is going. And then I'll decide if I'm going to stay. Well, you know, 2 months isn't enough time for this program to play itself out.
Yeah.
And of course, he's just going to look like an angel during 2 months, you know, who wouldn't?
<I'm> so true.
And she's only going to see all the best of the best. It's kind of back to that honeymoon phase again, you know, and it's not real intimacy building, because intimacy building is going to require the truth, truth about what we're feeling again, how we're hurting each other. And we both are. And we have to be able to talk about those things and know that it won't drive the other person out the door.
Wow. Thank you so much, Debbie. That was incredible. Well, that wraps up part two with Debbie Laser. I am so excited for all of you guys to check in and listen to part three, because she's going to be diving in and talking about the rest of the 15 steps that she believes will help a couple rebuild intimacy.
I'm yours until the end of time.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, Follow us on Instagram and sign up for the upcoming course. You can also connect with us on the Ask Us Anything page at restoredtomore.com. Also, quick note, all the work at Restored to More Inc., including this podcast, is made possible by our donors and financial partners. We wouldn't be here without those who have generously given to the cause of restoration. If you ever feel led to give, you can do so on the donate page on our website